This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this broadcast is provided by the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to AMDA On The Go. This podcast focuses on an evolving discussion regarding the important relationship between the skilled nursing facility and the emergency room. The Centers for Disease Control, CDC, paint a clear picture regarding the burden of patient care placed on emergency rooms, or ERs, in the United States. In 2015, there were 137 million ER visits, 12.3 million general and 1.5 million intensive care unit admissions from the ER, and 39 million injury-related ER visits. Nearly two-thirds of the ER visits required greater than 15 minutes of individualized patient care time. Given the typically increased number of comorbidities, medications, and potential impairments in function and cognition, the burden of elders on the ER is notable, as those elders over the age of 85 years had the highest visit rates for injury and illness, greatest number of imaging studies, and largest emergency medical services utilization. In a 2015 Journal of the American Medical Directors Association, JAMDA, article entitled "Identifying Potentially Preventable Emergency Department Visits by Nursing Home Residents in the United States," Burke and others reviewed that between 2005 and 2010, there were annually nearly two ER visits per nursing home resident in the United States. More than half of the visits did not lead to hospitalization. The majority of residents had normal vital signs on presentation, and nearly 20% of residents had no testing done prior to discharge. There were large numbers of brain imaging studies, as well as nearly 10% of residents receiving some form of sedating medication prior to discharge. The Burke group concluded that these aspects of care and transitions between the skilled nursing facility, or SNF, and the ER highlighted the need for seamless communication between the two. But despite the intimate need for both settings and the care of what ends up being mostly elder residents, is there a collegial working relationship based on the understanding of patient care, goals of care, mutual capabilities, or concerns between the SNF and the ER? Most would argue no. Is it possible to unite these very different settings toward a common language of resident care? Are the barriers between emergent care and chronic care insurmountable? Well, physicians such as Dr. Adam Perry have dedicated a significant amount of time and effort in advocating for a better system of communication between the ER and the nursing facility, offering some insight and tools toward understanding how we can build and fortify a necessary bridge of care. And Dr. Perry is with us now. Dr. Adam Perry is a community emergency room physician. He's a fellowship-trained and board-certified geriatrician, a certified medical director, and a faculty member of the Geriatric Emergency Department Collaborative, which is funded by the Hartford and West Foundations. Dr. Perry, welcome to AMDA On The Go.
Hi, Wayne. Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here and talk about this very important topic.
So, Dr. Perry, at the 2018 Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care annual meeting in Grapevine, Texas, you and Dr. Farisaidi joined forces in a symposium entitled "The Emergency Department Joins the Interdisciplinary Team, Strategies to Improve Acute Care Transitions and Reduce ED Capture." In this presentation, you discussed the SNF-ER transition process, unique challenges of caring for the SNF resident, presented geriatric ER guidelines, and offered a program designed to enhance collaboration between the SNF and the ER. Break it down for us. What is the state of the relationship now between the SNF and the ER? As an ER physician and a geriatrician, what do you see as the specific barriers of care between the two settings? And what is a geriatric ER? What can it offer in overcoming these barriers?
Sure, Wayne. A couple of questions there. I think the first one is important historically, in that the state of the relationship is improving, but looking at the literature and then, you know, and all of our practice over the years, I think we'd describe the state of relationship as sort of tribal and also sort of nihilistic. There's this feeling on both sides of the transition and in the literature that that there's nothing meaningful to be done. This is just such a vexing challenge. But recently, this persistently difficult transition, I think, is improving, and relationship is improving side by side as the two sites of care begin to share some incentives, and that will begin, hopefully, to build a foundation for improved transitions for our vulnerable older adults. There's certainly a lot of focus recently with healthcare consolidation and payment reform, and on the very crucial nature and high impact of this transition, with some of the numbers about transitions and admissions you mentioned earlier. That said, there are significant barriers to care. I think any of us who do clinical work, and certainly administrators who work in post-acute long-term care and in the hospital inpatient environment, can identify multiple barriers. But I like to think about them as sort of historically and then practically. And historically, the ED has always had a much different mandate than the post-acute and long-term care environment. The ED was not a coordinator of care in its inception. It was sort of a place where, like you see on TV, you know, you resuscitate and then people either get up and walk out, or they get, dispositioned, you know, upstairs or outside or the other way. And then historically, you know, the post-acute and long-term care environment was sort of the custodial setting, and there wasn't as much acuity or capacity as certainly there is now. So I think historically they had different mandates, and that began very different cultures. And the care occurs in different places, and the clinicians and nurses rarely interact with each other. And then practically, they're very different places. The speed is different. The environment is different. The shifts are different. You know, I often say, gosh, let me just call the post-acute and long-term care clinician. And then I realize it's 2 a.m. and they've got to go to work at 6:00. So there are certainly practical reasons that it's a challenging transition, and that's a massive barrier to care. Additionally, the reality of ER practices, increasingly throughput or the speed is really what's important as healthcare systems evolve with shorter lengths of stay and less staffing. So the ER is really concentrated on throughput and not really comprehensively assessing older adults with complex care needs. So one of the barriers really is just what happens in the ER. And one of the response to that is the geriatric ED process changes in the emergency department that are born of the geriatric emergency department guidelines. These are multidisciplinary guidelines that came out in 2013, AGS and a couple of emergency medicine groups and Emergency Nurses Association. And they just started to realize that, gosh, what we're really doing is taking care of older adults with complex care needs and lots of questions regarding the next step in their care. And so they started to realize that the ER is not the front door, it's sort of the front porch of the healthcare system, whereas an older adult comes in and gets admitted and has something done, the front porch where care is coordinated. And I think that's one concept I'd like to drive home today, that there are changes in the ER world, a growing recognition that the ER is a place where older adults come to get stabilized and treated and diagnosed, but also where care is coordinated. And hopefully we'll get a chance to chat about that a little bit later.
Let's focus on the question specifically of appropriate documentation, because this is truly one of the barriers as I see it. In another recent JAMDA article entitled "The Impact of Incomplete Nursing Home Transfer Documentation on Emergency Department Care," the authors discussed the significant percentages of lacking documentation from the SNF in the areas of cognition, mentation, functional status, and reason for transfer, which to me sounded like a grossly problematic transition process overall. Yet the study showed that sicker patients were considered somewhat sure bet admissions and received better documentation than expected, but then the use of standardized forms was also found to be lacking in critical information. This is a confusing picture. Where do we really stand in this transfer process? An ER provider, as you talked about throughput, needs to see, from my understanding, at least 2.2 patients per hour and really cannot dedicate time to review documentation as one would like or expect. So where is the sweet spot, so to speak, in documentation? How can we balance what the SNF can provide and the ER can receive and metabolize to even consider approaching the care of a nursing facility resident who may or may not require hospitalization?
That's a great question. And that article, recent article in JAMDA, has an interesting bit of nuance that I think sheds an interesting perspective on the question of documentation and decision-making based on that documentation. And the nuance is that, as you mentioned, even those older adults from facilities who didn't have complete documentation, the degree of documentation completeness or incompleteness didn't seem to affect the decision to admit. I think some other recent literature from 2013, there's one in American Journal of Emergency Medicine that shows that a lack of documentation does not affect clinicians' decisions to admit. And I think that underscores one of the challenges in this transition is that no matter how complete a paper document is, and we can talk a little bit about what that might look like, it doesn't provide that very important context to the ER provider, ER clinician, to make the really complicated decision regarding admission in an older adult with complex care needs and different goals of care and from SNFs with different capacities. So where do we stand in documentation now? I think some programs and increasingly are going to a warm handoff, which is recommended by a couple of different guidelines. And that helps the ER clinician with the context of, well, let's weigh the goals of care and the potential hazards of hospitalization with the family's situation, the trajectory of the older adult's recent course, and the capacity of the skilled nursing facility. So the warm handoff would be ideal, but that is certainly not possible in all or likely not in most cases. So if a paper document is to be used as it is in most settings, the article that you mentioned there gives a good description of the 15 elements that are important. But as is often the case in ER, more succinct, shorter is better. So some literature recommends a one-page document and then has, you know, 9 elements involved. It should always include a description of the acute change in status. And how is that a change from baseline mental and functional status? I think you mentioned, you mentioned that oftentimes that is not included, and that context is necessary for an ED doctor who's never seen the resident before. Certainly it should include information on how to contact the clinician to help with that medical decision making, because ED providers are, you know, you're dealing with a child in one room, and then you go in and you see an older adult who's got a multimorbidity and a change in mental status, and you really need the help. And my last point about the documentation is really to frame it as a consult. The PO, post-acute and long-term care clinician, knows so much more about this particular patient and about this type of practice. If it's going to be on a one-page paper or a transfer document, the clinical question is X, here's how to get a hold of us. And then you can help the provider make some decisions. If I can just expound on one other point I think that's real important with the documentation, please, and a way to get some help is that this transition is very complicated. There's an acute change in condition, and then the person who notices is likely the CNA at the facility. And then he or she will note that to the RN, and then the RN will talk to a clinician, and then the clinician will say, okay, sure, transfer them out. And then EMS shows up. And then EMS finds out some information or doesn't and picks up some paperwork, and then comes to the ER, and the person that they meet in the ER is just fulfilling a function, a triage function. They're likely not going to care for that patient. and then they hand that patient off again, and then they hand it to the provider, and then shift changes. So there's six or eight different information transfers here. We all have stories about how the information doesn't quite get transferred appropriately. So EMS is one place to focus. If you're looking to make a change and transition, EMS is sort of that universal link to think about how to change the relationship with EMS so that they can get some of the information to the ER clinicians.
Fascinating comment. It's like playing the childhood game of operator. You start out with one sentence, and by the time you get down to 10 different people, the sentence is completely changed. So fascinating, realistic observation about how many hands a patient touches in what we otherwise would think of as being a simple transition from the skilled nursing setting to the emergency room. And I put simple in quotes.
Our interview will continue after this brief message from the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Our foundation adds value to your membership in the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine by promoting workforce development, including the Futures Program, providing awards for innovation, and funding patient care quality initiatives. Learn more or go online and please make generous donations today at paltcfoundation.org.
We're talking with Dr. Adam Perry about the skilled nursing and emergency department relationship. Dr. Perry, in your presentation earlier this year, and as a segue to your recent comment, especially with regard to the consultant type role, you discussed concepts around an ER partnership, specifically focusing on one, speed, two, assistance with disposition, three, provider consultation, four, risk mitigation, and five, market pressures to collaborate. Can you expand on some of these points and help us understand how we can work with those points on fostering a optimal relationship?
Sure. Looking at this transition over 16 or 18 years of practice or so, I think it has improved some, and it has improved some because of some of the outside forces that are changing incentives. But we're certainly getting more calls from clinicians in the post-acute and long-term care environment now, and ED providers are likely calling clinicians in the outpatient environments more to help with the decision to admit or get some more valuable information. And some of those incentives that I think are real germane these days from the emergency department setting. One way to kind of conceptualize the emergency department is that it's sort of a real estate environment, in that you have a certain number of beds and you have an unknown flow rate, and you kind of have to move those beds and you have to maximally utilize those. And so fortunately or unfortunately, speed or throughput is so important. And so the ED provider has to evaluate a patient with complex care needs, often who can't tell you the whole story. Oftentimes, older adults from the nursing facilities have cognitive impairment that may or may not be recognized by ED clinicians. And then they have to make a decision about the next step in their care, you know, once they've done the diagnostics and sort of resuscitation. And they want to make that decision in a way that's safest for the patient and offer it doesn't expose them to undue risk as well. So with regard to those incentives, the post-acute and long-term care can really, really help. You can certainly help make that decision, decrease the provider and patient's risk for safe disposition. But you can also help from the post-acute and long-term care side speed things up by giving important context. We all know the story that someone fell, they're on Coumadin, so they're sent for a CAT scan. By the time they get to the, whisper down the lane transition, they're there for failure to thrive or some other such thing that is not exactly why they're there. And that can lead to a much longer evaluation than the focused evaluation that the clinician from the nursing facility sent them for. I think from the post-acute and long-term care side, there are some incentives as well. There's certainly a lot of focus these days on decreasing admissions or risk admissions from long-term care or from the post-acute side. And there are so many very interesting programs to to just not send them to the ER. There's, you know, paramedics in the facilities. There's advanced practice providers. Some facilities are just ordering CAT scans without going to the ER. But sometimes you need that emergency expertise and capacity, you know, CAT scans and labs and resuscitation and certain medications. And you need a certain question, a specific question, and what is the nature of this acute changing condition? Mm-hmm. So those are sort of the incentives which are aligning, and they're driven by forces in my experience that are sort of above either of the clinicians' settings. And so the ways that I've seen healthcare systems approach this transition and make positive incremental changes is to build sort of a multidisciplinary team and say, hey, look, it's time for us to safely improve the transition for these older adults. Many of them have cognitive impairment. And the successful transitions involve a few key elements. First, administrators on both sides are involved to really help change the incentives. Secondly, IT is involved to sort of try to automate some of this, although I know that IT communication is very challenging between sites. And then other members of the multidisciplinary team, the providers and the clinicians in the ER certainly are very important, but oftentimes, particularly in the community, they're not actually employees. They're oftentimes staffing companies who may or may not have much ability or interest in changing care processes. And then certainly the nursing staff, the DON and the ED nurse manager are probably very impactful players in the multidisciplinary team. And so when we talked about those incentives, it's a matter of identifying what incentives are shared and then each site finding what group of people, including administrators or executives, can develop what type of transition policy. And it's going to be different for different situations. You know, a small ER with one provider who you can just call on the phone versus a large place where there's, you know, six providers and they're changing shifts all the time. It's going to be different. But we recommend starting small and then measuring your outcomes and sort of doing the PDSA cycle, given that everybody's incentivized properly.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Perry, as has become customary in the time that we have remaining, I wish to be a little provocative with you, despite the fact that, you know, you clearly present some optimism in this evolving relationship. But I would share with you that over a year ago, members of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine, the American College of Emergency Physicians, the Emergency Nursing Association, the National Association for Directors of Nursing Administration, and the American Case Manager Association, all key players in this skilled nursing ER transition. We all met to review how each was invested. You talk a little bit about the investment in nursing resident care with the need to create some common goals to facilitate that care together. How could we make this transition better? Needless to say, the discussion became rather heated around multiple issues. The extent of documentation, as we've discussed, the needs to focus on resuscitation and admission, which many ER doctors say is their only responsibility. Appropriate nursing assessment, big issue on both sides, and patient, family, and provider understanding of capable, quality nursing facility care. Many folks don't understand what a nursing facility can do and whether it's quality to do it. Ultimately, discussion stalled. So I ask you, can we get beyond these stumbling blocks? What can we expect in the future for best case team-based, you talk about multidisciplinary team scenarios, in these transitions, especially as we look at the consequences, the risk sharing for hospital admissions being placed on both the emergency room and the skilled nursing facility settings?
What an undertaking, Wayne. What a challenge to have that group, and I applaud your efforts there. I think there's a few things that can shed some perspective and hopefully grow some optimism with regard to this transition. The first is sort of the historical mandate. Yes, ED docs, like, we just resuscitate and then transition, or resuscitate and then disposition. But the guidelines are born of the understanding of the reality that that's not actually what we do. And administrators are keenly aware of that, in that the ER is the focus for this sort of growing interest, in that emergency providers, clinicians make the admission decision, and that's such a huge decision. Once person's, you know, the decision's been made to transfer from the post-acute and long-term care setting, there's a lot of focus now on emergency providers making the decision to admit. It's a very impactful decision, not just from our utilization standpoint, but from the older adult themselves. There's lots of hazards of hospitalization. There's lots that can be done in post-acute and long-term care. So the ED is sort of, whether providers are with it or not, or the role of the ED is changing, and that's reflected in a few ways that hopefully can give us some optimism. The first is that the guidelines are out there, and you know, there's multiple societies that are trying to disseminate these guidelines, and with it, the understanding among ED practitioners that our role with regard to older adults is what it is. It's to coordinate care, and it's super important. If you look at the sort of trajectories of illness, you remember the old trajectories of illness, and there's that sort of chronic disease or organ failure trajectory where there's these increasingly frequent exacerbations with increasingly accelerated loss of function. ED providers are the people who can intervene early and really catch that and prevent the loss of function with each of those exacerbations. So ED providers are not only, we have to do this, we have to be good at it, because we're the people who have the training and really the capabilities in that setting to do it. So emergency providers are a huge part of the multidisciplinary care for older adults, and people are recognizing it. And that's been systematized recently in that the American College of Emergency Physicians has started something called Geriatric Emergency Department Accreditation. And it's something that's really caught on pretty quickly. And this is one of the reasons that we could have some optimism in that hospitals and emergency departments are going to become accredited or apply for accreditation for excellence in geriatric care. And one of the pillars of that accreditation procedure is to demonstrate that you have some quality improvement initiatives on board. And one of the most impactful quality improvement initiatives, and one that administrators are particularly involved with and interested in, particularly in alternative payment models, is decreasing readmissions. And fixing this transition is one way to do that. And to have quality improvement initiatives around fixing this transition or addressing it is one way to get people on board looking towards accreditation. So if I have any hopeful or optimistic message, is that things are changing in the ED. We're realizing we're part of the continuum of care, and hospitals and healthcare systems are becoming incentivized. If they want to be accredited, they've got to start working on some of these challenges. And this is a very impactful, relatively straightforward way to start if you can get all of the key decision makers on board. I hope that makes sense, and I hope it helps people conceptualize some of the changes from the emergency department world.
It's a wonderful end note to this conversation. We have been fortunate to speak with and learn from Dr. Adam Perry regarding the evolving potential relationship in the skilled nursing setting and the emergency department. Dr. Perry, thank you so much for spending your time with AMDA on the Go.
Thanks so much, Wayne. I'm very appreciative of the opportunity.
References for this podcast can be found at paltc.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this innovation podcast that we call AMDA on the Go.
Support for this broadcast is provided by the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM, pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast title. Thank you.